From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
There's ways to sever the information residing about us in databases from our physical presences. And you could do that through cryptography. So if these tools are really put to use, we're going to get our privacy back and still be able to do everything possible in this digital age.
You gotta wonder what information has been stored on computers about you. We know there's credit bureaus, the IRS, medical records, telephone bills, employment histories, you name it. Currently, whoever stores this information is required by law to protect your privacy as best they can. With the latest technology, such information could be stored in an encrypted form, and only with your permission could information about you be decipherable. Stephen Levy is the author of numerous books, including the 1980s classic, Hackers. He's written the latest cover story for Wired magazine on the phenomena of cypherpunks.
You can sell skin, you can sell bone around the world, you can sell virtually every aspect of your intestines, you can sell arteries, virtually every part of your body has some use.
It's hard to fathom that wondrous breakthroughs in medical technology can create black markets in their wake. Andrew Kimball is the author of the book, The Human Body Shop, The Engineering and Marketing of Life. Think about it. You've got two kidneys. Why not sell one? How much do you want for your kidney? Now ask yourself, what's the difference between donating the gift of life and selling the gift of life? Now, here's Moira with Stephen Levy.
Stephen, you recently wrote the cover article for Wired magazine on crypto rebels with a cause. Who are these people, and why should we be interested in them?
Interestingly, they call themselves cypherpunks, which is a play on cyberpunks, the techno movement, cultural movement sweeping the nation. They're activists, really, for our privacy. They believe that cryptography, which traditionally has been really arcane technology, really reserved for diplomatic corps and the military to protect their secrets, now has an importance for all of us because it has the potential to protect our privacy in the digital age. And there's forces which don't want us to use cryptography to protect our privacy, to protect our personal information, and that is, strangely enough, our own government, which wants to reserve these privacy tools for itself and make sure we can't converse and conduct our business in a way where they can't see what we're doing.
Now, this leads us to what's been called public key encryption. What is it, and how does it work?
Okay, I think I have to go through a little background into the way cryptography works before we can get what public key really is. Traditionally, cryptography, which is the protection of secrets, passing secrets and keeping them so eavesdroppers can't read what they are. Traditionally, this has been done by starting with something you call a plain text, which could be just a plain letter or cable or whatever, and encoding it in a certain manner, whereby someone who intercepts it before I send it to the intended party can't read it at all. If I were to send a letter to you saying, I'm going to be on the radio tomorrow, I would encrypt it using what's called a key, and if someone grabbed it before I was able to get it to you, they wouldn't be able to read, I'm going to be on the radio tomorrow. All they would see on the page was gibberish. If it got to you before they intercepted it, you would take this gibberish and then use that same key to decrypt it, and the gibberish would be transformed back to my original plain text that was called, and you'd be able to say, oh, I'm going to be on the radio tomorrow. Well, the problem with that is the key had to be kept very, very secret, and there would be a problem. If I had difficulty getting you the key and I have to hand it to you personally, we really couldn't talk in that way. And when you try to consider cryptography being used on a massive scale with many, many people keeping their communication secret, this whole problem of the keys makes it almost impossible. Well, about 20 years ago, some people came up with a terrific solution to this problem. And interestingly enough, these people weren't involved with the government, which did most of the cryptographic research. They were on their own, and actually they were privacy activists. One fellow in particular is a fellow named Whit Diffie. And he figured out a way where you could do these exchanges without having to physically hand over the keys. And he called this public key cryptography. And it works this way. You have not one, but two keys. Each person is assigned two different keys, just like social security numbers. You'd have two different keys. One key would be public. You would be able to give that to anyone and still be secure because you would hold the other half of the equation, meaning your private key. So if I wanted to send you a message, I would have your public key, which could be published in the equivalent of a phone book or something like that. You would give it to me with full confidence that your privacy would be protected. And I would then encrypt that message to you using your public key, and no one in the world except you could decipher it, decrypt it, because only by use of this private key could you decipher it. And, you know, it worked the same way in the opposite direction.
I am a little confused. If the public key is published in a general directory, everyone has that public key. Do I have to also give you my private key?
No, you hold on to that private key very closely, even more closely than you would your little code number for your ATM machine. As a matter of fact, one fellow said, you can get my private key when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers.
I was going to ask you about that.
For complicated mathematical reasons, you need both keys to decipher the thing. You can't have one key. It doesn't give you any head start in deciphering it if you get the public key. They have to work together, and that's due to mathematical reasons we won't even begin to get into here. It's complicated enough.
If I remember my old books like The Key to Rebecca and that type of thing, which was lots of fun, it's like the key was the fourth, seventh, sixth word in that order. And so you sent a big, long message, and you picked out those words, and then from the book Rebecca, I think, and that was the message they were sending. So obviously the key is how do you either transfer or elaborate on or choose from or however select from, mathematically apply formula to some message so that you can find out what the real issue is.
Right, now, but we've had a revolution over the past 20, 30 years in computers. So the kinds of keys that they used in World War I or even the Napoleonic Wars and earlier than that, which did ask you to manually change each letter to something like that, can all be pretty quickly broken by computers, by supercomputers either belonging to government agencies or even personal computers belonging to individuals. So you need a much more sophisticated way of scrambling up the text that you're sending and the information now. That's why we've had to use such high-tech methods. The really interesting thing is that as sophisticated as these methods are, you don't need to be a big government or a giant industrial agency in order to participate in this revolution. Computers, small computers even, are so powerful that you could crack some pretty good codes using a garden variety workstation. That's why we really need the best cryptography possible, because so much of our information now is either transmitted digitally or stored in databases and passes around from one place to another. And as the electronic revolution, the information highway gets put in place, more and more of our private information is going to be shuttled around. So we really need these tools to protect our information, not only from big agencies, if you're worried about the government, but from saboteurs or thieves or people who might want to use it against us in some way.
I have some questions about that, but I'd like to sort of complete my earlier question, is that if you have a public key, I'm sending a message along some electronic super data highway, and you have the public key, and I have the private key. On your end, do you have to have my private key with the public key to decrypt it?
No. You will. When you send a message to me, you use my public key, and therefore the only person in the world that could make that message back to its original form is the person with the private key, me.
Oh, I get it. So if you and I are communicating, there's two public keys and two private keys.
Exactly. Each person has two keys. Interestingly enough, if I were to do it in the other direction, if I were to decipher a message or encipher, to scramble up a message with my private key, anyone with my public key could read it. And you might ask, well, why is that? You know, it really wouldn't be very secret. Of course it wouldn't, but what it would verify is that only one person in the world sent that original message, and that was me. And what you have there is the equivalent of a digital signature. So for the first time now, you could receive something over a computer network and know with absolute surety who sent it.
That's true. Even if there was a gun to their head saying, send this now with your key, you
right.
knew it
That's
came
right.
from them. That's good.
Right. Well, yeah, I might pull someone else's key to decipher it there. But the importance is that it really shuttles us into a new stage in our ability to conduct business and communicate with each other in the digital age.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Stephen Levy, widely read author, and you will remember him from his 1984 book, Hackers, the Heroes of the Computer Revolution. We have just talked about public key encryption. Is this any different from Clinton's proposed plan for clipper chips?
Clipper chip is going to use that. Let me take a second to explain what it is first. It's something where the key to unscrambling these messages will not only reside in my hands, in your hands, in the person who holds the key, but in the government's hands as well. It's the same as saying that you can get a very strong lock for your door to protect your house, but we have to have a key to it also in case we want to search your house, we meaning the government. Now, with this Clipper plan, and some people are calling it the wiretap chip as opposed to the Clipper chip. I don't know if I'd go that far. But originally, it's going to deal with voice communications. And as you know, cellular phones, for instance, are very vulnerable. Essentially, you're broadcasting with a megaphone. Anyone can listen to what you're saying. So a lot of people say we really need strong protection for our voice communications, among other things. So the solution which the Clinton administration has proposed really is a leftover from the Bush administration, in which they're saying, all right, we're going to give you a way to protect your conversations. And it's going to work, I think, a little like we described in public key, only you won't actually have to handle the keys. The stuff will be built into the telephones you buy with this protection. What's going to happen is that if the government wants to listen to your phone conversation, they're going to be able to go to a repository, actually two repositories, each of them holding half of the key, and get your key and listen to your information. Well, this gets a lot of people very upset, not only because they don't want the government listening to what they say, but because they feel if the government has it, if the key exists somewhere outside their protection, it's the whole system is compromised. You can't be sure it's only the government who can get it because you know that the key exists somewhere else. And ironically, Whit Diffie, the fellow who first invented public key cryptography, did it solely for the reason that he was very unhappy with other kinds of schemes which didn't keep the key in your protection. That was really the whole point of public key cryptography, is you can communicate with 100% certainty that no one else could be eavesdropping. So the very point of using this system is to make sure your communications are secure, and if you use the Clinton Clipper chip, from the start that your communications are not 100% secure. And that's what has a lot of people upset about
playing. Well, now we're getting the heart of some of the matter as far as I'm concerned, and that is that quite often in the early stages of any technology, and I'm saying by early stages, the first 50 years, 60, 70 years of the telephone, it's so primitive from where it's going to go that there are certain things that are accessible about it, such as being able to wiretap, and there may be other aspects of it, of any technology when it's new. There are many things about it that we don't understand. Before telephone and being able to record things and microphones and that type of thing, if you were in a room and you were speaking quite softly, nobody could hear what you were saying.
Right.
And in the early days, we could wiretap. And now we're getting to the point where, in fact, We can have a complete telephone system that no one can wiretap.
We have the capability to do that. As a matter of fact, because of this revolution in cryptography, we have the capability where not only phone conversations, but all our communications can be 100% privacy protected. And some of these cypherpunks call this crypto anarchy. and they delight in that possibility. Some people think this is the worst thing that could happen to our society. Some people have actually told me that they believe that if this happens, the society itself would crumble, because the government and other, quote, responsible agencies should have the right to monitor certain communications. And really, traditionally, our national security, I guess you could argue, has been enhanced by our ability to capture diplomatic communications, say, from other countries, or military communications, and and crack them and use that information. So there is another side to this, and it really comes to the basic issue. The technology has come to the point where it's made all this possible. You know, the genie is out of the bottle, so to speak. So the people who want privacy compromised to a certain degree, like the government, are fighting a battle not only against activists like the cypherpunks, and I hope we'll talk a little bit about their activities, but really the whole forces of technology. It's just trying to put your finger in the dam. I think in the long run, they're going to have problems keeping the gates of privacy closed.
There's two levels here that I'm perceiving that the government is interested. Certainly in the wiretapping, we're used to this type of thing to fight crime, and that could be drugs, it could be any kind of crime. You go down to the courthouse and you get a warrant or whatever you get, whatever the technical term is, and then you proceed to what we've always called wiretapping, only there are not a lot of wires left,
right.
But I'm sure it'll have that name for a while. And everyone, you know, viscerally believes that, hey, this is a very positive thing, and yet how far can it go? How far should it go? Then on the second level, what you're talking about is national security, which is why a lot of the state-of-the-art in encryption technology has been developed under the aegis of the National Security Agency. That's right.
That's true, yes. In the first area, the crime fighting, the FBI and other agencies point to successes they've had, convictions they've had, which relied on wiretaps. Though I think officially the number of wiretaps in a given year is less than 1,000 nationally for all the country. And that includes not only federally ordered, but ordered in a state level too. So it's really not a lot of cases we're talking about. And anyone who's conducting business on the telephone is conducting illegal business probably knows that, you know, they're in danger of having their conversations intercepted. Interestingly, the FBI is behind, you know, yet another government initiative we haven't mentioned yet, because the new telephone technologies are making it difficult, they say, to implement all the wiretaps they get permission to initiate. They want a new law which actually is going to cripple the entire phone system on the basis of making it easier for them to conduct wiretaps. So they wanted to actually have the whole industry do their new designs with one eye towards thinking, gee, we can't do it this way because then it would be difficult to wiretap. And that proposal is called the digital telephony, and they're trying to get that through in Congress. Obviously, a lot of people are upset about that idea. They say that, you know, that's really not one of the criteria we should use in designing our communications infrastructure. The second area, national security, is a little more difficult to justify because, or to evaluate, because the NSA is very secretive. Really, that's part of their charter, and they don't boast about their successes. So we can't judge how much recently their eavesdropping, their code breaking, has benefited us. It's brought us great benefits, they don't talk about it, so we don't know. On the other hand, we do know that cryptography moves not only in this country, but in other countries too. So you could be sure that the most advanced forms of encoding are being used not only in our country, but outside the country as well. So you really can't say by passing laws and doing things in the United States that we could be sure that other countries won't use the very sophisticated forms of cryptography that we're banning to our own citizens. So it could be of limited use to say, well, we're going to pass all these laws to say we can't go this far in cryptography. We have to use a weakened form. We have to escrow keys and things like that, because outside our borders, there are no rules like that. And as a matter of fact, there are certain programs which companies in the United States are not allowed to sell to outside the country, to international sales, but they're being sold in the streets of Moscow, those same programs. So, you know, it has a limited value to pass our laws here when information flows very freely past borders now.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Stephen Levy, widely read author, and he recently wrote the cover article for Wired magazine on crypto rebels with a cause. Let's go outside the United States, hearkening to the export restrictions on cryptography technology. In Europe, they've developed the GSM encrypted telephone, but apparently the encryption aspect won't be exported from Europe?
Well, you really get into a whole thicket of rules and regulations when you come to this. The difficulty is that while individual governments, you know, want to do certain things to protect their ability to either crack codes or keep their communications private, there's this revolution going on outside the governments where, you know, people who are interested in other things like privacy or, you know, protecting their communications or even perhaps trying to break other codes are operating using, you know, powerful either personal computers or computers belonging to institutions. And they're all connected, many of them, through the Internet, which knows no borders. So, you know, you have a situation on one hand where the government's trying to control traffic, but the tools are widely available. They really can't suppress them. What effectively this sort of export regulation does is limits it not to the people who really are motivated to get sophisticated encryption tools, but to the average person. For instance, if Microsoft wants to send their next operating system with encryption in it, they can do that within our borders because the First Amendment, as of now, protects encrypted messages, but they can't ship it overseas. So what Microsoft does is they say, well, gee, it costs us a lot of money now to do two different versions of our operating system, and a lot of companies won't buy it because they have, you know, places overseas and they're not going to use two different kinds of systems. So what we'll do is we'll use the weaker version that we're allowed to export, and we'll use that for both our domestic version of the operating system and our international version. So what happens is that the people, even in this country, wind up using a weakened form of encryption in their everyday communications, which perhaps is weak enough to be broken not only by our government, but by saboteurs, thieves, industrial spies.
John Perry Barlow, co-founder of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, said something you referred to earlier. You can have my encryption algorithm when you pry my cold, dead fingers from my private key. How serious are these people?
Well, these people are extremely serious. These people, the cypherpunks, are highly motivated, you know, to protect individual privacy, and some of them are actually, you know, working on the fringes of what's permissible to, you know, basically make these tools and put them into circulation and damn the consequences. They really feel that this is a time where sometime in the near future the government might impose some very strict bans on strong cryptography. And their goal is really to create powerful tools and put them into circulation now. So if the government ever decides, you know, in the near future or the midterm future, that we can't have this, we can't have these 100% privacy tools circulating, it'll be too late. They'll already be out into the world and you won't be able to stop them. So, and they meet physically in different locations. There's one in the Silicon Valley, and now there's a place, a physical meeting in Boston. There's one in England now. But generally, they meet online over the Internet, and they exchange information there. You know, there's a vision that these cypherpunks have that cryptography can give us a freedom that really has been taken away from us a little in the information age. Right now, It's very easy to construct a very complete profile of someone just by scanning different databases and putting the information that you get from those databases on a person, their credit records, their medical records, their driver's record. And as you know, time goes on, we're losing our privacy, and it's really at the mercy of anyone with a modem now. And what cryptography can do, using sophisticated variations of what we're talking about here, is actually restore that privacy to people. There's ways to sever the information residing about us in databases from our physical presences, and you could do that through cryptography. So if these tools are really put to use, we're going to get our privacy back and still be able to do everything possible in this digital age. And that's really the vision of what these cypherpunks want us to work towards. And, of course, there's an alternate vision of saying, well, gee, there's a benefit to the government being able to track down every transaction a person meets. They see to the future where all our financial transactions, even buying a newspaper, very trivial ones, will be electronic. And some people in the government think, gee, wouldn't it be great to track every single financial transaction down to the penny that everyone makes? So to some people, it's a nightmare, though.
There's so many things that leap to mind when you talk about this. It used to be one thing when we talked guns and butter. You could track the guns coming in and the butter going out, and you could have a customs agent, and you can do all that type of thing. What physically goes across your borders? Now we're talking about beaming information electronically, which you can't put your hand out and grab, and everything is different. I often go back to the student revolution in China. Just after that, that's when they had a number of fax machines in China, and even though there was a huge information shutdown, the students in the United States and from other parts of the world were massively faxing in information to China, and there was nothing anybody could do about it, government or otherwise. And when we're talking about data and we're talking about information and the kind of technology that it is, how anyone or anybody really expects to be able to sit on it is, talk about a losing proposition. I don't know. Maybe somebody will figure it
right.
out.
It is difficult to suppress these tools, but what really would make them very effective would be to put them in mass circulation, to make them part of the infrastructure. Though I really don't want to minimize that there are issues and problems we're going to have if crypto anarchy takes place. One of the interesting things that the cypherpunks do is they're starting these bulletin boards and mailing systems called remailers that enables you to send a message with total anonymity. Somewhere between the time you send a message and the time it gets to the recipient, your tracks have been totally erased through these sophisticated cryptographic methods. Now, some people think, this is just great. I could, send messages separate from my physical persona, and it would never be able to be tracked to me. And it might be a good technology, for instance, for whistleblowers to be able to point out dangerous situations without being identified as the person who's pointing this out. On the other hand, some people are unhappy with the idea that people can send anonymous messages, that people should have to be responsible for what they say. It's a legitimate argument, and I think it brings up a lot of interesting issues of how we're going to use these tools.
In terms of an orientation to information that an individual provides, I was fascinated by the concept of providing only a minimum of information for any transaction. And specifically, one example you gave was being stopped by a policeman and only giving him your license number, but not your name. He didn't really know your name. Let's talk about that concept.
Well, again, that's a way of using these cryptographic tools to sever our physical persons from our digital persona, this whole dossier which one can get from us now by linking information that resides on various databases about us. Now, what the cypherpunks say is that we should have the maximum privacy in any exchange that we could physically have. So if someone is checking for your mortgage, for instance, they would only get that information which is relevant to what they need to evaluate your credit record. The information you gave, why does a policeman need to know your name when he stops you when you're driving. All he really needs to know is whether this person has a driver's license and, you know, whether you have any arrest record against you, if there's any reason he should stop you.
Address. Your address is sitting there.
Sure, or your address. Sometimes policemen might stop you in a rural area. He or she might be more inclined to give you a break if you live in that area. Well, why should that be an advantage? Why should that be a piece of information which should be relevant to how a policeman treats you?
Moira's guest has been Stephen Levy, author of numerous books including Hackers and Artificial Life. He's currently working on a book about cryptography. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with Dr. Moira Gunn. Andrew Kimball is the author of The Human Body Shop, The Engineering and Marketing of Life. Moira was able to speak with him about viewing human body parts as a commodity.
I think the perception of most Americans is that the use of elements of one person's body to be used in another's is a lot like our community blood banks.
Right. Nothing, I think, affirms our community values, our connection to each other, even anonymously, more than donating our blood and making sure that our organs are donated, for instance, in the unfortunate event of a car accident. These are wonderful things we do to reaffirm what it means to be part of the human community. Unfortunately, this is not the only way we disseminate body parts in this society. Due to really dizzying advances, which we've all seen on our front pages, on organ transplantation and reproductive technologies and fertility treatments, and now the cutting-edge technology of genetic engineering, where we're mixing and matching human genes and the genes of all the other animal species, formerly not very valuable body parts now can be worth billions. You know, when I was a kid, we always said the body was worth about $2.89 worth of chemicals.
That's
you remember
right.
that?
I remember that.
And not anymore. Now that we can take human genes, for instance, and grow them in a cell line that might produce valuable anti-cancer agents, or now that we can manipulate embryos and sperm and eggs to create new babies through surrogate mother contracts, and now that through organ transplantation we have a very good percentage of survival, each of those body elements has become extremely valuable. And this, unfortunately, has led to a very unique kind of exploitation, which is the poor, the economically disenfranchised, often women, selling their body elements, their reproductive systems, for a price to those who can afford the price. And my book really tells their story and hopefully so horrifies the reader that they agree with the biopolicies that I have at the end of the book and how we can stop this, how we can get the benefits of this technology without taking these terrible risks of exploitation.
There's a tendency to rush into technology here and say, what's the hottest, latest, greatest? One thing that I learned from your book that I didn't understand is that why don't we think of blood banks? We think of this wonderful blood bank community and only 1% is paid for. And we just think, you know, starving students and artists, you know, that sure will help them out and that's good. It wasn't always like that. When it started out, we didn't have a lot of community blood banks. Why don't you tell that story so people can see this transition?
Well, that's right. As a matter of fact, there was great competition in this country between paid blood banks and volunteer blood banks. And volunteer blood banks really came about because of the repulsion of both our policymakers and our medical community for the kind of exploitation of the poor that was taking place. An interesting story I tell in the book really has to do with the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua. Antonio Somoza, who was the dictator of Nicaragua prior to the revolution there, his family owned almost everything, including the blood bank in Managua. And the head of the newspaper chain, a man named Chamorro, published stories about how the poor were literally having themselves bled to death in order to support their families, even on a poverty level, and that then the pharmaceutical companies of the first world were taking that blood and using it to produce valuable products. Well, National Public Radio went down, and the world tension was focused on that. A few days later, Chamorro was shot and killed in the streets of Managua.
Wow.
When the Sandinistas came in to Managua, the very first thing they did was burn down that blood bank and Screaming Vampire Somoza. The revolution then spread from there. So you can see how what an extraordinary metaphor it was for them that this dictator was literally taking the blood of the nation, selling it to the first world for exploitation. Unfortunately, that was stopped. But as I describe, there is organ bazaars around the world where wealthy first worlders and third worlders can come now to buy organs.
Now, where are those most prevalent?
Most prevalent in Egypt and in India. Those are the two real centers now, but there's a problems in Korea, throughout Asia, and throughout Africa, and even in much of Eastern Europe. The new big market for organs is in Eastern Europe. If you open any of your West German monthly magazines, you'll see numerous advertisements for Russian, Hungarian, and Yugoslavian organs for sale.
Really?
Yes, yeah, because of the extraordinary economic problems there. We needn't feel that superior because the California Supreme Court, just a few days ago, issued an opinion, first time in history, saying that a surrogate mother, a birth mother, who had gone through all of the pains and difficulties and risks of pregnancy, was no longer a legal mother in the state of California. This doesn't mean that she had given up her rights. What the California Supreme Court said, really extraordinary, is the first time in Western history she is not a mother at all. And what this allows is essentially rent-a-womb.
Yeah.
Okay, what we have here is the first time California is now saying that you can rent a woman's womb for 9 months, treating her manufacturing process of your baby as if she was manufacturing a computer or television set for you. And this creates a whole new business, potential business, in people who can afford the price, not wanting to go through the risks of pregnancy, right? Having their
or can't,
and having their sperm and eggs united, perhaps genetically screened for gender, which is possible. It's being done all the time now, and then implanted in the surrogate mother. 9 months later, you get your two kids, one boy, one girl, no risks, no fuss, no muss, and the rent-a-womb has no rights. So you can see the commodification of body, and particularly of women's reproductive elements, is going on apace. We've always sold sperm and eggs in this country, and it's something I think needs to be stopped. But certainly this heightening of it through the surrogate mother business is an extension of the human body shop into women's bodies in a unique way. I call it a form of bioslavery.
Now, you refer in your book to, and I'll quote, centuries-old scientific creed that the natural world, including our bodies, is devoid of any sacred meaning. This, of course, makes the body parts industry the commercial trade of mere objects or commodities. How much of that is because of the scientists, and how much is it because of the business people?
Yeah, that's a very good question. What I trace in the book is kind of an unusual history that most people don't know about, which is that while we made machines over the last 300 or 400 years, the machines were kind of making us too, at least making the way we think about our bodies. And when William Harvey first discovered the whole nature of circulation, he said, you know, this looks, the heart and the whole circulatory system looks a lot like a pump. And so that began kind of mechanical metaphors. And by the time René Descartes, the great philosopher, came out, he was convinced that all animal bodies were nothing but machines. And the Cartesians were one of the first vivisectionists, and they used to laugh at the sounds of the animals, the screams and yaws of the animals, thinking they were just like a machine that was making various creaking sounds when it wasn't being used properly. They actually thought this. And then by the time we got into this century, Helmholtz and the other scientists in thermodynamics said, no, it's not a simple machine. The body is an energy-producing motor. And they devised these famous exercises to make sure that workers were, you know, absolutely perfectly efficient in their work. And that's what we have today, a lot of the efficiency stuff we have. Finally, we're all part of the computer revolution, right? As genetic engineering came by, we now think that genes are little information chips. and that our bodies are, you know, we have feedback and data, and we now have the new analogy of ourselves as computers. So as we've evolved in the creation of machines, from simple machines to motors and computers, believe it or not, we think of ourselves now in a very similar fashion. And there's even scientists being paid with our taxpayer dollars, for instance, who are trying to download the brain into computers because they think the two are analogous. So the machine metaphor is amusing, but it's also very dangerous.
Yeah.
Because if we begin to think of our organs and our genes as nothing but mechanical parts that can be exchanged in just as machine parts can be, then that encourages the creation of a human body shop very similar to an automobile body shop. where you can just exchange parts at will. And we've lost something terribly important about the reverence, the awe that is owed living things, that is not owed non-living things. And that, of course, then definitely creates the intellectual and political climate for the human body shop.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Andrew Kimbrell, author of the book, The Human Body Shop, The Engineering and Marketing of Life. One thing that I've grown up with and have come through many evolutions personally on, but has never left me, is that while we took a body, it could be of a human or a dog, or there is a life spirit, if you will, or something, a soul, many people call it, that joins together. And whether the body, the machine can operate or not, without the soul, it was not going to.
That's right. And there's some marvelous capacity. I mean, so much of life is regenerative. You know, if you take a leg off a starfish or even a simple worm, it grows back. Try that with your computer and see how far you get as far as taking a piece out of the computer and waiting for it to grow it back. Now, there's a magic both in the biology and certainly in the mystery of consciousness that we're never going to find in machines. But remember, the whole philosophical crew we just talked about, from Descartes to Lemaître, even to Galileo, they didn't believe that. They definitely felt that you could explain everything, and many mechanists and positivists and many scientists today feel that you can explain everything in totally mechanical terms, including consciousness. So this is certainly one of the great debates, and I do discuss it. I mean, after I sort of tell these horrifying stories throughout the book on genetic engineering, I do say, well, let's examine the philosophical underpinnings. And I think that's so important because, you know, if we look back, we've had a very poor history in limiting our technology to beneficial purposes. I mean, around the turn of the century, the nuclear revolution gave us the X-ray, which is a wonderful device when used properly. But the nuclear revolution also put us on a trip line to our Megadon with the nuclear weaponry. Right. Okay, I'm not against fertilizer. I mean, somebody who does a lot of gardening, I think it's swell. But you'd have to be extremely misinformed not to realize that the petrochemicals that we have put through the environment in an uncontrolled fashion have led to actual threatening the biosphere itself through global warming, acid rain, this whole new nightmare of global environmental threats that we're just now becoming fully acquainted with and debating. Well, it would be very naive this time around when we're talking about mixing and matching the genetic makeup of the whole animal and human kingdom, which I talk about, when we're talking about manipulating the reproductive elements in women's bodies, when we're talking about organ transplantation, new advances there, to assume this time around that we're only going to use it for beneficial purposes.
What are the different parts of your body that can be sold?
Well, to list all the parts of the body that could be sold,
give us 20.
We'll go through the rest of this program.
Give us 10.
Certainly, every one of your major organs is now
all vital organs.
All vital organs. Now, in the Organ Transplant Act, you cannot sell them in this country for transplantation. What most people don't know is you can sell them for research. By the way, I hope I'm not giving anyone ideas out there. The whole point of this book is to make sure don't do this. So, you know, oh, good, I just got a new investment idea.
So if I decide I could live with one eye, I could sell my cornea or my whole eye.
To research, absolutely. Right now you could do that. And certainly if you traveled, you could do it in any number of countries where it would be legal to do so. Additionally, you can sell skin. You can sell bone around the world. You can sell virtually every aspect of your intestines. You can sell arteries. Virtually every part of your body has some use. And, of course, we already talked about blood through the new technologies of transfusions. Let's say you've recently had measles or recently had, you know, somebody suffering from lupus. Your blood is producing valuable interventive chemicals, whether they be antiviral agents, antitoxin agents, antibiotic agents, that they can take out of your blood and use for pharmaceutical. Mm-hmm. Of course, you can sell your sperm. Women, you can sell your eggs. Many clinics now around the country is about $2,000. You can sign surrogate mother contracts and rent out your womb, and if you're a genetic surrogate mother, part of your genetic heritage. And now, you can every one of our 100,000 genes is a potential commodity. There's a story I tell in the book, which is, I think, pretty extraordinary. An Alaskan businessman by the name of John Moore had a cancer of the spleen. He came down here to UCLA, and they operated on and took out this cancerous spleen. Well, the doctors and researchers involved saw an opportunity, and they took a small piece of his cancerous spleen, turned it into a cell line. It's an immortal cell line. They had it grow artificially, right? And it was producing valuable anti-cancer agents, inoculin, interferon, and several other anti-cancer agents. They patented it, just like you patent
John Swain.
Yeah, exactly. They patented and sold it for millions and millions. They licensed it for millions of dollars, and many predict that the ultimate net worth of that will be $3 billion from a cancerous spleen. By the way, John Moore finally found out about this. They didn't tell him. He finally found out about it and sued them, saying, "Hey, that's my. Those are my cells. You're making millions, hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions of dollars of profit on my cells. What's my cut?" And this went all the way through the California Supreme Court. And finally, the California Supreme Court said, "Well, you don't have any rights in that part of your body," they told John Moore, which is something of an anachronism, because they're saying that the university could patent it, make, and the companies could utilize it, but he doesn't. They did say, however, they kind of compromised and said that the doctors had breached a fiduciary duty, you know, a duty to inform him that they were about to score big time on his on his spleen cells. And so I think they're right now back in the lower court seeing exactly how much Moore will get. But this just gives you an idea of some of the extraordinary legal and ethical issues and how small parts of the body no one would have even thought about before, was simply discarded, can now be worth millions and billions of dollars to the new biotechnology industry.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Andrew Kimbrell, author of the book, The Human Body Shop, The Engineering and Marketing of Life. Now let's take the example of John Moore. Many of us have gone into a hospital or a clinic and had something cut out of us. You know, who owns it? Where does it go? It just kind of disappears. I mean, does the hospital own it? Does your surgeon own it? Do you still own it?
Right. Well, most of the time, you may not even remember it, but you probably signed a consent form. And I think after the John Moore case, these consent forms are going to be different. So read them carefully, and you'll probably see something like saying that even if it's for commercial uses, you somehow free the doctor of any liability for not informing you, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, allowing them essentially to use your tissue. So read those consent form carefully, you know, consent, which we should do anyway. But now I would read them even more carefully, because remember, they could be making millions or even billions on your cells. The whole idea of patenting life, by the way, is a remarkable legal development, and is very recent. In 1980, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, decided that you could patent, and this was General Electric, a genetically engineered microbe that was supposed to eat oil.
That's right.
Unfortunately, they never did figure out what it would eat for dessert, so the oil-eating microbe never became a commercial product. But the legal precedent was set, 5-4. Very narrow margin for the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, what the Reagan-Bush administrations did unilaterally through the Patent Office is extend that decision on microbes to include human cell tissues, ultimately human genes, genetically engineered animals, and genetically engineered plants. And what most people don't realize is that our researchers now have the ability to program, edit, recombine, delete the genetic information of life, just like our ancestors soldered and heated and combined the inanimate elements mm-hmm. of the earth to create the great machines of the industrial age. We're kind of in this transition from the old industrial pyrotechnologies to the new age of biotechnology, where we're creating new living things just like we created the new machines of the past. Our taxpayer dollars go to old Dr. Vern Purcell up in Beltsville, Maryland, where he took human growth genes, put them in the permanent genetic code of pigs to create a super pig, supposedly to feed the world. Of course, the super pig didn't turn out to be a super pig. It was actually bow-legged, arthritic, and being our government, they put a spin on it saying, well, maybe we've created a lean pig. I don't think they ever took a survey, by the way, whether people are ready to eat pork chops with human genes in them or not. But we will be seeing many genetically engineered foods, perhaps even including such pork chops, in our supermarkets soon. And I think it's going to cause a lot of concern among consumers. One of the most terrifying stories is when researchers at NIH, again using our taxpayer dollars, took the entire genome, the entire human AIDS virus, and put it into mice to try and create perfect AIDS research tools.
Mm-hmm.
Altruistic? What's wrong with that? Well, what happened was that Dr. Robert Gallo and some of the other major AIDS scientists in the country published a paper a few months later in Science Magazine What they were concerned about was the AIDS virus melding with native retroviruses in the mouse to create a super AIDS. And Gene Marks commented in Science magazine that this new super AIDS
could be even worse than the last AIDS.
And transmissible through air.
Wow.
Now imagine that. So even this is an altruistic experiment in creating these transgenic creatures, and it could very well turn into a major nightmare. So when we start mixing and matching the genetic code for utility, for profit, even for altruistic reasons, we must realize that we don't know what we're doing. And one of the things that I recommend in the book is a moratorium on changing the permanent genetic code of animals and certainly humans until we have a far better idea of what we're doing. These are very sweet problems for scientists, but they could lead to huge environmental and human health impacts unless properly limited.
Well, you know, the parallels that I think we see is, you know, we know the Industrial Revolution started spewing all this stuff into the atmosphere, and then we had all these cars, and who knew the depletion of natural resources and the effects on the total global environment of all these cars and heat and all of that. And now we're coming to understand this. And we see how in a major global system, those things can have major global consequences. At the microbiology level, we don't know what we're doing any more than we did then. I mean, we're doing research, we're trying to contain, we're trying to look, but that's what science is about. I mean, that's a fact. It's not an alarmist fact. It's not a conservative fact. It's just a fact.
It is just
a
fact.
As you march through science, and any kind of science, you don't know. And you don't know. If you did know, it wouldn't be science anymore. It'd be behind you. You'd understand it.
That's right. And the key element here is as science becomes technology and then gets disseminated through society, no one, and certainly I am not against scientific research, but scientific research now is being developed in technology and into real-world products so quickly that that's where we haven't intervened. As I said, they now are, for instance, finding out all about us, our genetic predispositions to schizophrenia, to cancer. Who should have that knowledge? Insurance companies are already using that knowledge to discriminate against certain people in insurance policies. If you're predisposed to a certain disease, they're going to raise your rates. The Office of Technology Assessment just said that several of the Fortune 500 companies are screening workers to see if they're predisposed to certain cancers in their workplace to limit their own liability if a worker should become ill. I would prefer, by the way, they clean up the workplace and not genetically screen the workers. And as we described earlier, we're already screening the unborn for non-disease traits. So we can see what all of us would think is a wonderful thing, finding out more about the mystery of the human genome, these 100,000 genes that somehow interact to create who we are. That's marvelous. But already, since there is no buffer between the research and its use in society, it's being used for some very pernicious discriminatory reasons. I happen to think genetic privacy may well be one of the major civil rights issues of the next century.
Let me ask you something. You mentioned earlier the human growth hormone and a story that many, many Americans know about and felt very close to was the Lyle Alcedo story.
What most people don't realize, Lyle Alcedo, of course, was NFL pro football player. This guy was fantastic.
Huge character.
And a marvelous and aggressive football player. But he finally told his story to Sports Illustrated, and it turned out to be sort of a typical one, unfortunately, for our highly competitive sports world. He took steroids to create that football body he felt he needed for success. And then later on, when he tried to make his comeback, took genetically engineered human growth hormone in order to try and create that body that he felt he needed for his comeback. And, of course, he then was felled by a very fatal and fast-working form of brain cancer. Now, that's a tragic story, but what most people don't know is the rest of the story, which is that there are thousands of parents around the United States who are injecting their children, mostly boys, by the way, with genetically engineered growth hormone 3 to 5 times a week. Why? Are these boys sick? No. Because they think the boys are too short. You see, two companies, Genentech and Eli Lilly, produce now genetically engineered growth hormone. We all produce it through our pituitary glands. But through genetic engineering, they're able to produce industrial amounts. And they've sold the American public on a bill of goods, which is that if your child is normal, but in the bottom few percentages of height for his or her age, they're sick, and they need this treatment. Now, if Charles Darwin were here, he would assure us that there is no evolutionary advantage to being tall versus being short. Being short is a part of the natural diversity of human forms. But these companies have a cure with no disease.
But wait a minute. There are people who suffer from dwarfism.
There are indeed. About 2,500 across the country.
And they are helped by these drugs.
This is an important drug for them. And as a matter of fact, that's a good point. Genentech and Eli Lilly got something called orphan drug status. Whenever you create a cure for a very small group of people, the government wants to reward you for your altruism because you're such a good company. But it turned out that Genentech and Eli Lilly had far bigger plans than a few dwarfs. Last year, they sold over $200 million of human growth hormone. In the first quarter of this year, $55 million. It's the 34th leading drug in America. That's not going to dwarfs. What that is going is to tens
or the
of,
dwarves are very rich.
Right. It's going to tens of thousands of normal children who are being genetically engineered because they are short. And this presents a very disturbing scenario.
Now, is that because of the parents' aspiration for the children or for our
That's
doctors?
It's primarily parents' aspirations. They go to a doctor, and a lot of the pediatricians have been wined and dined by Genentech. They've been at this extremely aggressive marketing plan that's been reported, and I document in the book. And it's been an extremely unfortunate situation because, you know, we used to think that the solution to discrimination and prejudice was to educate those who had that prejudice or who were practicing that discrimination. Now we can already see in the example of this huge selling genetically engineered product that the new solution to at least some kinds of prejudice and discrimination is to genetically engineer the bodies of the victims of prejudice to get rid of the trait that's being discriminated against. If height is first, what's next? Is it obesity or is skin pigmentation next? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But this presents, I think, a very disturbing scenario for the future.
To bring it around to what we were originally talking about is that, yes, the scientists together objectify what is going on, but in the end, once there is technology to sell, the business of business is to sell it as far and wide and as profitably as they can. And what we have to look at, what you're saying, is let's look at the total picture. Let's look at the ethics of what we're doing and try to move that forward.
That's exactly right. The market should not invade the body. You know, the market is a wonderful device. You know, Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, probably is the most influential book ever written. And I have some problems if you extend that concept all the way through the human body. You know, we extended the market principle to the earth. And right now we're seeing some of the tragic consequences of assuming that the earth was an unlimited commodity that we could exploit at will. And after seeing what the market has done to the earth, I think we should be very concerned about having those same free market principles applied to our body, our genes, our genetic heritage, and every element that is part of us. And so I say in the book, and I have several biopolicies that involve no patenting of life forms, that involve no sale of reproductive elements. Again, donation, as we started this program with, is wonderful. That affirms community. But when the rich are selling, when the poor are selling this to the rich, that's just old-fashioned exploitation. And we don't permit people to sell themselves into slavery. We don't permit people to work under the minimum wage. And we certainly shouldn't permit the selling of the irreplaceable of the poor to the rich. Additionally, I recommend limiting these genetic techniques to the curing of serious diseases. That's where this technology belongs. It doesn't belong in gender sex selection. It doesn't belong in a new eugenics. It doesn't belong with employers and insurance companies and the government discriminating against us because of some genetic predisposition we may have. It certainly doesn't involve genetically engineering the victims of prejudice. It should be used and solely used for the treatment of serious disease. And I have a series of biopolicies that, if enacted, would accomplish that.
Moira's guest has been Andrew Kimball, author of the book The Human Body Shop, The Engineering and Marketing of Life. It's published by Harper, San Francisco. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans in Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for additional facilities at WFCR-FM in Amherst, Massachusetts. For TechNation, this is Mike Amatori. TechNation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.